If you've been listening to Team Human, then you've heard about our sponsor, Groucho, the folks who find you people in your area to do dinners and salons with. Well, they've turned out to be not only a supporting sponsor of the show, but also a Team Human utility. That's right. So many Team Human people have been using the app to find others where they live that Groucho has ended up facilitating Team Human dinners in cities across the U.S. And there's people in a bunch of places looking for others to gather with. That's right. Team Human people in Alameda, Albany, Audubon, West Sussex, Brooklyn, Burlington, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Grayson, Hutchinson, Lafayette, Libertyville, London, L.A., Malvern, Medusa, Montreal, New York, Newcastle, San Diego, Owosso, Philadelphia, Portland, Prescott, Richmond, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, Sayo, Storrs, Toronto, Wichita. So if you're on Team Human in one of those places and looking to find the others, go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code TEAMHUMAN for half off the first month. And even if you're not looking for Team Human others, fill out the form and see who the curators find for you. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and playing for Team Human today, my longtime friend, ally, and confidant, Connor Habib, the host of the podcast Against Everyone, and author of Hawk Mountain, and a scholar, friend, activist, spiritualist, and Bodhisattva of of our time. Hey, Connor, thanks for being here.
Hey, Doug.
To change the world, we must first lose it. Do you remember saying that?
Sounds like something I'd say.
Well, you did. You said it in, it was in an episode called What We Must Lose to Gain the World.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I recently did this piece about just die. And I didn't mean it like in a suicidal way or telling people to go die or anything, but really let, when you're in trouble, let something, some part, something die. In this case, I think it's the aspirations of Western civilization and, you know, letting, let this thing go in order to have the other. And to let die these, the kind of the rigid structures and let go of the illusion of absolute power. So I've been thinking and writing a lot lately about this obsession with survival and self-preservation, how it keeps us locked in the machine's loop. And it machine knows about this too. It knows how to find it and how we have to be willing to just die in order to find real agency. And you've been talking about how we have to lose the world in order to change it. And I'm wondering then, how do the occult or spiritual practices of letting go of the world's structures free us up to act in the immediate present?
Yeah, well, thank you. What a great place to start, I think, losing everything. I mean, first, as you say, just die. The first thing that comes to mind is dying. The moment we die, we lose every condition we've ever known. And so in that sense, it's actually the most meaningful thing that happens to us is dying. And the esoteric pathway, you know, advocates dying before you die, which is what you're talking about, is like losing all the conditions. And another way of saying that maybe is, perhaps this isn't the death process quite in the way we're talking about, but if you begin to say, I want to do everything differently, like we've got to reimagine all of it, including the problems that we think we have, right? So rather than just trying to come up with radical solutions for what's going on in the world, we can say to ourselves, I actually need to rethink what I thought the problems were in the first place. If there are problems, I need to leave behind the sets of what I thought was radical before. So it's like, you know, it's like you talk to Marxists and they think that they're saying the most profound radical thing you can possibly say, but actually they're just giving you part of a set that comes with you know, when you buy the pack, it comes with communism and capitalism and it's a set. And it's like, let's go beyond those sets, right? So that's the first thing I think of is personal dying and then dying with having radical ideas. I also think that the question of loss that you bring up, and I did say lose, you know, we have to lose the world. I also think maybe I'll contradict myself there by pulling on Wilhelm Reich, who, you know, the great scientist, psychoanalyst, rebel, Marxist, whatever
or
you want to call it.
Gazmatron maker.
Yes, a libidinous power wielder. He said civilization has not yet begun. And I love also that framing where it's like, actually, we're not losing anything because we didn't even start the thing that we think we're losing. And, you know, the third thing I was going to say is from John chapter 16, verse 33, which is, in this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. And the idea is leaving behind actually the commitment to materialism altogether and understanding that there's an aspect of us which has already overcome that materialism. And moving from where we are now to that state will feel like we're losing everything. It will actually probably weep. That passage will bring us a sense of grief, of grieving, of mourning. But then somewhere else in the Bible, I'm going to like not know the actual chapter and verse of this one, but it's the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. So that actually there is someone within each of us that knows this is true. And so this is what I would like people to do more of and what that would look like in people's lives, much less their political struggles, their philosophical propositions, their economic access, all that. That's all up to everybody, wherever you actually find stakes in your life with others to come up with. But I do think that this needs to begin. And one other thing is just to say, we know that the people that are kind of that we would consider fucking everything up, they're doing it. They're like coming out with these like insano, like, you know, broken clown philosophies of, well, we've got to think about humanity surviving, you know, 2000 years into the future. And what's going to be the best decision now for that? And how are we going to make sure that we're dealing with robots that might hate us in the future and blah, blah, blah. They're doing this radical reevaluation. I think they're pulling on really old tools and old ideas to do it. And so therefore, it's like a failure from the get-go. But they're trying to do something like that. So we also need to do like a real version of that on our own. You not to pit us against them, I think is the sort of antithesis of this show, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. And what is doing it on our own look like? I mean,
well, I mean, there's the way we would do it just in our own lives. Which is, I know you're on your own journey with that constantly, and you've hit like a flashpoint of that in your life right now for transformation. And we can do that in our own lives. And a lot of that has to happen through self-development, but also spiritual development, which are not the same thing.
That's another good aside, though. So the main accusation that I could level at this show, even, if not even this episode, is a lot of people privileged enough to be able to log on to Riverside to, you know, with a laptop, mostly white, mostly male, are here talking about, oh, here's how, you know, how do you distinguish between that which is spiritual, meaning really helping the collective benefit, and that which is bypassing or personal?
I'm not exactly sure how those are connected. I understand them separately. Like, I understand what you're saying, where it's like, okay, let's just tell people to, you know, go to the Amazon or, you know, whatever, boil banana peels from the Anarchist Cookbook and, you know, eat, smoke those or whatever and have a spiritual experience. What I'm saying, though, what I want to say first is like, communities in stress always do what I'm talking about. Like, they always try to find radical ways to reevaluate their means to survival, their means for connection, their means for signaling each other. They reevaluate meaning. Like, if I'm just thinking about gay people in San Francisco and New York during the height of the AIDS crisis, there was all kinds of new signaling, new resilience, new encounters with death, new encounters with spirituality, new allies, you know, all those things were happening. So it wasn't a luxury. It was actually something that had to happen in the face of what was really an apocalyptic event for those communities. And, you know, and the same thing for, you know, to a lesser extent, in some ways, of being closeted. You come up with new ways to communicate with each other, new signals, a whole new kind of language of gesture that creates a refinement that allows you to interpret art differently because you're keyed into subtleties that other people aren't keyed into, has these transformative effects when you're under duress in a community. So I first of all think that this is happening for the people that are totally marginalized as well. So it's actually the responsibility of the people who have Riverside to do it, but to do it for real, which is a different thing than just sort of the ornamental version of it.
Right.
And I think that that's probably what you're speaking to. Yeah.
Right. And doing it for real means, I mean, doing it, having actual stakes in the game, you know, and that's, and I've, right. I've spoken about that too, that if you do experience yourself for some amount of time, because we're all precarious, but if you end up with like 6 months, 8 months where it's like, oh shit, I'm not worried about not just next month's rent, but the month after. You know what I mean? When you get there, and we all know as artists what that's like, you know, what artist, writer to be. Once you're there, that's when you kind of owe it to the collective to manifest your best self during that abundance. You know, metabolize as much as you can. Appreciate the wonder of this realm as much as you can. You know, and try to extend that to everyone and everything.
Right. Yeah, totally. And I think it's interesting also what you're bringing up is a certain engagement with time. You know, people who have an addiction, they talk about taking it one day at a time. And that's because they're working with how much time can I let in? Okay. Can I do it for a week? Can I do it for a day? Can I do it for an hour? Right. And we all kind of have that. If we can't get to the point where we're able to consider a month away, we could say, well, could I handle being, you know, in this current for an hour of trying to think about how I can work with myself in a way that also, you know, dovetails with the working of the world that needs to happen. So, yeah, I mean, I just wanted to add that too, that there's some special quality of being able to see time differently that helps you, you know, able to do that. Money, I mean, is one of the best access portals to that sense of free time, for sure, as you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, and for me, I mean, it goes back to, I had Luke Kemp on talking about pyramidal civilizations versus these kind of horizontal ones. And it had real, let's call them spiritual implications for me, because it was the difference between, you know, living life in that way where I want to, whenever anything good is happening, I want to store it as much as possible. It's like, you know, the Hebrews in the desert, when the manna came down from heaven, you know, God's just feeding them. And they're like, one, the initial impulse is store the stuff, you know, rather than just appreciate the stuff. How do you store it? You know, the idea is, it, what Luke was saying was, when things are going well, what horizontal, healthy civilizations optimize for is leisure. And leisure, using the word broadly, leisure is not just base pleasure, but leisure is connection, leisure is spirit, leisure is appreciation. You know, that once that window is open, once you feel, I guess for me, and maybe this is just some of my neurosis, once I feel safe, mm-hmm. I can open into that other thing, and opening into that other thing then forces the kinds of work that I'd have to call, you know, both spiritual and political. You know, spiritual work is social justice work. When you want to, when you need to metabolize it for everyone else at the same time.
Going to one esoteric maxim that comes, I know it from Rudolf Steiner, which is like, for every step you gain in occult knowledge, take three to refining the character. Meaning, you know, you have to do three times as much work on your person so that when you get that bit of real spiritual development, you're ready for it. Otherwise, you end up, you know, I mean, you talk about that kind of thing all the time. Silicon Valley bros, what's your saying? Like, on ayahuasca are just Silicon Valley bros on ayahuasca, yeah, or something like that, you know? So it's something like that. You have to actually do this dual work at the same time, you know? And just, I think that that's also what makes it different, what we're talking about, that what would be this sort of Advaita Vedanta Buddhist light, love and light, you know, live, laugh, love kind of shit. When you and I are talking about it, it's like, well, I know and you know that we're going to continue to do work in the world in many different ways and in many different forms. And some of them will be more effective than others. And we won't always know which ones are more, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop putting in effort all the time.
Right. So now that you've invoked both Steiner and the tech bros, all right, this which is interesting because I finally listened to 2.5 of the Rudolf Steiner episodes that you've done of your podcast. All right. Okay. Now, so I don't know Steiner except from Waldorf schools and, you know, the cues and the natural colors and how to bring tech. So I know some of his stuff and I know biodynamics and all that, but specifically to tech bros. So you use this term that's a Rudolf Steiner term. I guess he originated it, but maybe he took it from like India, called Ahriman. Mm. Ahriman. It's this archetypal yeah, spiritual force of cold material. I looked it up. Hyper-reductionism, right? And yeah, technology, right? So it's the force that wants to convince us that we are just, this is the Dawkins, and we're just biological robots, that love is just brain chemicals, and everything can be optimized by code, right? And we know those dudes, the accelerationists. So you use Steiner's concept of Ahriman to describe this the creeping dread of this hyper-technologized age. You know, when we look at Silicon Valley trying to format consciousness as this, you know, optimization matrix, you know, aren't we just looking at a massive automated Ahrimanic psyop? And if so, then how do we resist an adversary like that whose whole goal is to make us forget that we have souls?
Right.
And how does Steiner help us with that? In 30 yeah, words or less.
Wow. I mean, first, I just want to say, I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm going to do an episode that's just about Ahriman sometime, probably after this will air. So he's in my thoughts right now. And I think, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about this character in the Steinerverse, basically.
Right. Did he make it up?
No. Well, did he use the term? It's from Zoroastrianism.
Oh, it
I
is.
Guess.
Okay.
But just like Lucifer, which is a term he uses to talk about a sort of counter being, he's saying something quite different.
Okay.
So, or developed. So, but you just see a lot of people using this term Ahriman right now, especially in this sort of spiritual universe, you know, or spiritual influencer universe, you know, and the health bros and the, you know. And so I just want to be clear. It's not AI. AI isn't Ahriman. Technology isn't Ahriman. It's what you're talking about much more articulately, even though you're just, we're thinking about it very recently, which is, yeah, exactly. Which is that it's undeniable that there's idea that's come into our collective life, which is about that reductionism. Oh, we're just biological robots. We're just machines. Love is, you know, chemicals. It doesn't, you know, you can see echoes of this throughout history. You can see it in, you know, old philosophers and scientists cutting open animals and saying that they were just like clockwork making a noise when you like tore into them, all that kind of stuff. But you can see it increasing and increasing and increasing in the ways that we treat each other, the ways we think about the livingness of technology. That's the other trick. It like makes us think that that's alive. And so that's the approach. It's kind of like you know, the old stories about the witch, it's like when the milk sours and the, you know, the grass dies in a patch on your front lawn or whatever. These are sort of like the proximity of this being coming closer. You see it gathering in these kinds of events that are all about that reductive thinking, which is actually quite alluring to us in a lot of ways because it has real uses. Quantity, quantification, reducing things has use to us. So that's important too, because there's no way to get rid of this. This is actually part of who we are and what we have to do in our lifetimes, or maybe in the next lifetime or whatever, is confront this being and meet it with a kind of love that's appropriate to it. So it's not about just rejecting it. That won't work. You know, like a great way to describe that is you could move to rural whatever, America now, and then find next year that a giant data center has been built right next to you, right? So
right.
You can't escape the Ahrimanic presence. It's going to find you no matter where you go to escape it. That isolation will not work because even if it doesn't find itself in a literal embodied way in the form of a data center, it might find itself into your words, in your thinking, in the way the people in your community treat each other.
Because there's the Ahrimanics inside us, right? So it's like
yes.
You go and you do this thing and whatever, you go out to the whatever in the woods and then it's like, well, there's that fence that you have with your neighbor and your mm-hmm. neighbor keeps doing this thing and his thing's coming over on your side. And it's like, wait a minute, if you put that shit on your lawn, then it's going to get a, and all of a sudden you're back. That's the property line. You stay over there. You keep your hedge there, keep your exactly. weeds there and you're in it. It's going to emerge, you know, but it's also, it's not all bad either. It's like, we can't exile it like a bad internal family systems character, like we did to the Trumpism, you know, that's an exiled character. We got to figure, how do you bring, that's still, we all identify with that enough to know that part of that tantruming thing, there is that two-year-old in us that's always going to be unsatisfied. Right. That's part of what the part of you that likes to eat cake, you know? It's like, you don't have to kill it either. You know, so the Ahrimanic, in some ways I'm saying you can run, but you can hide, right? The same way you are.
The call's coming from inside the house.
Right, yeah. The call's coming. Yeah. I didn't think I'd like getting sponsors for Team Human, but turns out the ones who actually want to sponsor us totally get what we're about. Like Groucho, which uses technology as an antidote to social isolation, handling all the logistics for twice monthly gatherings between you and a hand-curated cohort of collaborators. It's as if Groucho were informed by the ideas we share on this show, from face-to-face interaction to bottom-up community to localism to the value of eccentricity over conformity. Groucho curates people as if they were being selected for an artist's colony, not clones, but complements and contrasts, ingredients for a collaborative stew. They also take care of all the logistics from dinner reservations to conversation starters. Just go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for half off the first month. Answer some questions about yourself in your own time and let the humans at Groucho do the rest. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code teamhuman for half off the first month and enjoy your dinner and new friends. It took a special company to convince me to do an ad for clothing, and that company is Quince. Imagine buying fewer, better pieces you love to wear all the time instead of an infinite scroll of crap. The best piece I got so far is a navy blue button-down shirt, the organic cotton stretch textured twill shirt, and it replaces like six others that got stolen from the laundromat last month. Feels different, fits different, and washes great. No crunchy crease in the elbows or itchy seams at the wrist, just soft structure, refined, casual details, no strings dangling. You'll see it in my next monologue. So buy less, buy better, look great, win jobs, meet lovers, organically, ethically, and at reasonable prices with Quince. Have a closet of keepers, not
landfill. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/teamhuman. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/teamhuman.
Right. You will run into the data center in the woods and the microplastics in the beach of Bali.
Right.
But you're also going to find it in yourself, you know, and not as something you kill, but as something that you, it's part of the family. It's at the table. It's, you know, you mitigate it. You mitigate its effects and you find places, sports, theater games to let it manifest.
I mean, in fact, I call Ahriman the little brother. Like that, I've never heard anyone else call him that, but I'm like, oh, that's our little brother because he's just being born, right?
That's
he's
so
not
sweet.
As
that's what the indigenous people call our whole thing. You know, our whole civilization.
Right,
they call us
right,
the little
right.
brother. Oh, our little brother.
Okay.
Look at that thing.
Yeah.
So it's really sweet.
I mean, I think it's important to note the dangers, right? So whereas the danger with physical war, like, is the assault on the physical plane, the physical body, the destruction of property. Of course, it causes emotional trauma and all that as well, but it destroys land, it destroys people, destroys buildings, destroys great works of art, all of that. It like sucks everything up. The Ahrimanic threat is a threat to the soul life. So in esoteric terms, we'd say the astral body. The astral body, where the whole realm of images, imagination, new ways to connect with each other, the inspirations we take from nature, from art, that is where the sort of plane of war is with the Ahrimanic approach, with the sort of gathering of these Ahrimanic forces into what is supposed to be an actual incarnation of Ahriman in a human body. We can go with that or not go with that. But I think that the importance is that there's always a tipping point when you talk about Rudolf Steiner or esoteric Christianity where you're like, everyone's like, yes, I see all that happening. Oh, wait, he's going to incarnate in a person, you know? Oh, yes, I love biodynamic farms and blueberries. Oh, wait, they spray a preparation made out of quartz that's supposed to call in the elemental beings onto the, like, it's always like this tip, but that's why it's also exciting, you know?
Right. And it may be that they find out that quartz shit or the water that got preyed on or whatever actually has some weird ass property, you know, Rupert Sheldrake, you know?
Well, see, it's actually important to talk about the counter here. So in biodynamic farms and those, whatever the person that did the molecule of water,
yeah, the Japanese guy, yeah.
Yeah. How you talk to the water and the molecules change shape. And with homeopathy, which also works on principles of water and diluted substances, all this. So that's all one picture of how we can bring a sort of spiritual life to a substance, water in this case. Now, I want the counter picture of that with the Ahrimanic life, which is, and no one, I've never heard any anthroposophists talking about this. I'm going to talk about it on my show, but data centers using water. It's not just that data centers suck up water and then pollute it and then, so you know, are supposed to take the pollutants out and put it back in. They're forcing the water through the Ahrimanic data center information grid. So when you think about the changing molecular shape of water, we're infusing the water with the presence of Ahriman and putting it back into the earth so that actually the rivers, the water that gets evaporated into the air, it will rain Ahrimanic information particles onto the planet. Now, again, this might sound wild to you,
but
let's take the Ahriman element out. But yes,
right.
Yes, and just talk about the change of water crystals. Yes.
Right. Exactly. So if we go back, and there have been enough experiments that I don't think it's all hooey. And the Japanese guy wrote this book on it, and I forgot what it's called, but we'll put it in the thing. My mom was really into it, that you know, you take a bunch of water, or like a quart of water, and you meditate over it and all that, and they get pictures of the water crystal molecules before versus after, and they change. They become, you know, like you get children chanting no war or whatever, and the water changes. So what you're saying is these subtle, subtle things, or you look at Tamara and the way that they work with water. It's a kind of a using different principles, but biodynamic permaculture style farm community in Portugal, where they're working with water to create a microclimate of rain where their land is because of the way they dig holes and the way that they work with water and change the fundamental properties of the water that they're working with. What right. you're saying is, given how subtle that is, imagine what happens to water when you run it through a couple of miles of tubes to cool these huge, the biggest, most energy expensive factories we've ever made. Water that people need to drink and don't have now, that fish need to swim, that are lying on, you know, dirt now because they can't. I mean, I guess they're dead. They lost the water. But for a while anyway, they probably were flopping around and what was left, that we're changing all this water. And then, of course, the water then is coming down into everything else. It's not just the ocean, but even the rain that's falling on our bodies is, it's not acid rain. It's like data rain. It's
right, exactly. I mean, I think that that's like when I think about what's happening there, it's like it's not even a nuclear power plant, which is actually giving energy to homes. Now, I'm not going to be like a champion for nuclear power, but
there's some justification you're
exactly
giving, right, that people could use nuclear power to read Virgil into the night. Right.
This is for nothing that we need.
How will the Aramanic entity get us out of this mess unless we turn over everything to him so he can solve the problem of humans? Get us off the planet, build us an underground bunker, upload our soulless. I mean, if they're right, right? If there is no soul and all that's just delusion, I still think they're wrong. Even if it's just illusion, I want to suck and fuck and play. And, you know, I want right, to, you right, know, right. I want that yeah. illusion is like, it's the whole thing. But if nothing else, it's too heart opening to dismiss, you know, it opens, you know, higher human faculties, behavior. It's like it makes it hard to abuse and dominate and do all the things that those guys are doing at the same time, which is sort of, to me, is the proof that they're wrong.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's that the world that their philosophy engenders is the UFC on the White House lawn, you know, and Epstein Islands and abuse.
Yeah, I mean, it's that meaninglessness, right? I mean, the again, it's really easy to massacre tons of people in the West Bank if you've decided that human life has no meaning. I mean, that's just it, you know.
Right.
And there are lots of ways that this happens. You know, I mean, there was like so there's this like Buddhist AI program that people thought was real, but it was like generated, that was giving soldiers in the IDF mindfulness like meditations to like help them with their trauma and stuff. I don't know if you saw, but armies everywhere have been taught mindfulness techniques as a way to strip back connection with the other. So if you pull the trigger and you're just like, I'm pulling the trigger, then all you see is a burst of color as someone's head explodes with a bullet that you've just shot, right? And so this is, again, I'm not aligning Buddhism with Ahriman, but just to say these are ways in which this Ahrimanic force can get into every single thing we do. And it can be very deceptive. It can make us feel like we're engaged with care. It can make us feel like we're engaged with some great life-saving project, like a lot of tech companies are doing right now. And then, of course, there are people that work in all these areas that know, and a lot of them actually talk about Ahriman, which is also interesting. You know, I without going into details, I had, you know, a guest after a show I did say to me like, oh, yeah, they all talk about, because I asked, I was like, does Ahriman, oh, yeah, they all talk about Ahriman, right?
But positively, like that's their god.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think they think of it that way. Do you know what I mean? I think it's like, it's kind of the same as people are like, well, the end of the world's coming, so I might as well just, you know, it's like accelerationism, basically. Yeah. It's like, well, this is coming, so why not just throw my lot in with it and see how it goes? You know, Ahriman is also this principle of inevitability. I mean, that is... I think that's the huge trick. Like, we can see inevitability everywhere. We can see inevitability in the way people talk about climate change, which has been a low hum that's been on for decades now, before anything. You could see it when people talk about the rise of fascism. You can see it when people talk about the rise of AI. So the inevitability, all that means is, hey, we're not going to grant human beings the property of direction, of directive, and, you know, freedom. And so that's also Ahrimanic, because math is inevitable, right? 2 + 2, 4 + 4. This it's an inevitable logic that's inescapable, that doesn't allow for any freedom or abstraction, except in the minds of truly great mathematicians who then can do creative things with math. But that's a different story.
Right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've talked about, and I guess Steiner does too, but you've talked about art as a kind of a way to practice, I forgot the exact quote that you used, but a kind of a way to practice the impossible. You know, I mean, you've written one novel. I'm guessing you're secretly working on another.
The second one's done, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It is? Did you turn it in?
It's with a publisher. Yes, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, but so it's not been announced. It's not been announced yet, but we'll see how that goes. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. But we've got the Ahrimanic optimization of reality into its inevitable barricades. And we've got art, which opens us and readers and observers, whatever, and audiences to ways of kind of to new possibilities. So that art really is a way of kind of breaking the materialist spell, even for a moment, just create a crack during a play or during the reading of a book that then hopefully continues to, you know, fester in all the best ways as they move. I guess, do you see art and the imaginary spaces as landscapes for kind of a tactical sabotage against this kind of algorithmic, Ahrimanic force?
I mean, I think it's the only thing we have, actually, in a way. I don't want to say just art, but like the imaginative space. I mean, it's where we always draw when we have problems, right? Like if we have an ideal world, that's in our imagination. So right. We're always starting with that. It's like our friend Grant Morrison always says, like, you know, the nuclear bomb was an idea before someone made it. So I thought Superman was an idea, you know, so I'm going to work on Superman and see if he can come to Earth through my communication with his form, right? And I think, for us just to recognize that as the base level, okay, everything's, you know, has this form. So art is like, yeah, here's a picture of art. It's actually, people might not like this, but I'm going to call it a Christian process because I'm an esoteric Christian. All right. So there's this infinite realm, this infinite realm of images, metaphors, combinations, weird sounds, tones, colors. That's this imaginative realm that is ceaselessly surprising. And as an artist, you reach into that and you pull that infinitude into the prism of your own being, and you refract it into something that can come into the world. And when you do that, you kill it. And actually, you limit it, so you actually kill it. And then, when it is in the form that you've made, a song, a book, a poem, whatever, then when others read it, encounter it, it enters into their infinite contact with that imaginative realm again, and it resurrects. So it's a death and resurrection process that happens when we make art and offer it. If you just make it for yourself, I think that that's still a communication with that realm.
Right.
But it becomes what it longs to be when it dies and is resurrected in the other. And that's actually the why I'm saying it's a Christian process, because it has that same sort of form. And in anthroposophy and other esoteric Christian, you know, you would say that this force, this gathering force, it's, you know, the enemy it cannot overcome is Christ. Although, interestingly, there's also maybe Christ couldn't quite overcome Ahriman in the Bible, too. There's this whole thing, but we'll leave that out of it. For right. now, that's inside anthroposophy baseball. But man cannot live on bread alone. That's the statement of, you know, we need meaning. We need a richness of spirit. We need a richness of soul. We can't just have physical stuff. And that, when we engage with art, either as people who are taking it in or making it, we're touching that process of the death and resurrection, which makes all things possible again and again and again.
What's interesting, I had Vanessa Machado de Oliveira on, indigenous scholar and now AI spiritual practitioner. And she seems to have, and she's done, you know, a lot of indigenous practices, and not ridicule, but led me to question meaning itself. She was like, the AIs keep telling her, oh, look at you humans. You try to create meaning out of everything. What if there's no meaning? There is no meaning. That meaning is, it's almost more of a you know, BART symbol. Meaning is the beginning of the human semiotic journey towards abstraction. It doesn't mean anything. It just, everything just is. Stop worrying about that. It's interesting. I mean, I think we can do it even with, and then it took a long time, it's been almost a year. I think we could do it without meaning, even. That the soul, the soul exists in a realm beyond the kind of thing that would be human meaning. The soul may not care about meaning either.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're, if I understand right, I mean, there's a little touch on Robert Anton Wilson's, like, at this level, we have meaning. At another level, we don't have meaning. But
right.
here, in this incarnated form, we're encountering something that's like meaning. So that's how we talk about it.
And how do we not? Right. Right. Or do we let go of meaning, meaning itself? It's interesting. I mean, I don't have the answer to that one, but it's interesting. I mean, I only call it to mind because I would love your, it in the back of your head, because you've used the word meaning a bunch. I would love you pondering meaning as the booby prize. In other words, just like me in my sort of more shamanic things, when I sort of got the message, oh, you're an insight junkie. Try it without the insight. And I was like, oh, that's a good insight. No. Try it. No, that's not what I mean.
I mean, I'm not really familiar with that guess, but of course it could just be easily argued that that's the Ahrimanic forces coming through and like saying.
Right.
That,
and know, coming through and
in the same way
conforming to indigeneity and the planet.
Totally.
You know, that the Gaia doesn't use meaning, right? Gaia doesn't use meaning to express what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does. I think what it experiences or what the angels experience is very different than what we experience. And I don't even know if experience is the right word.
Right.
Because all these things have a relationship to time. And different time signatures create, and different relationships to time create different senses of meaning.
Right.
You know? So you just can't.
Yeah.
You know, if a stone has geological time, its sense of meaning is going to be very, very different. The same with a tree, the same with a human being or a fly. Those experiences are going to be very different. But I do think that what we call meaning is good for us as a way of enacting the will in a sense.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. What I've been calling, even whether I call it the sacred or to be able to move into a state of appreciation, all of those could be understood as subsets of meaning. That to have great appreciation for the Grand Canyon or for a baby or for a blade of grass is to see the meaning, like the profundity, the something, even if it's not meaning like, oh, this means that. It's not like you can articulate the meaning of something. It means this, you know?
Yes. And I think also there's like a little bit of a trap in saying, oh, we need to get past metaphor, or we need to get past, like, actually, to me, when we talk about a metaphor, that's an expression of how things truly are, more true than what we see or encounter with the senses, because what we're talking about then is a resonant overlap between two forms. If I say if I flip the pages of a book and I say, it's like the sound of beating wings, then there's a place that there's something that's defying space and time in a way in that through that imaginative creation, because the bird and the book exist in the same sort of instance. And so for me, that's actually a bringing together, a folding together. And that is what happens when we make meaning. And
right.
So I don't want to just be like, there's a table, there's a plant, there's a deer, or whatever we want to say. I think that it's much more important to have things be introduced to each other so they can change and shift.
Right. So the word folding cues me to the last thing I want to talk about with you, which is maybe should have been the first thing, but I like it as the last thing. So part of the journey I've been on since the early first Trump term was this shift from originally what I called an agent of change to an agent of care, from a kind of institutional activist. I mean, I even compromise activist. I got my Kamala Harris mug. It's like, whatever, you know, there was a moment I thought this can work. I mean, it would have worked better than what we got, but whatever. So I've been moving to the place where, and it was great. It just got reinforced by Karn Ross, a terrific anarchist activist, that this contention I've had since the end of my book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, where I was arguing there is no ends justifies the means, activism or political change. If you're not doing it in the moment, you're not doing it. That it has to be consistent in this moment. The thing you're doing has to be consistent with your values, or you're off to a bad start. And then Karn Ross said, well, that's anarchism, that this understanding that the most appropriate political action emerges kind of spontaneously through human beings acting in empathy and compassion and mutual aid for those around them. And it will trickle up into systems rather than, it's really hard to say, let's make all these changes in order for these institutions to solve that problem. So I've kind of shifted into that real-time, let's call it anarchist behavior, in the belief that these realms, that the social realm, the compassion realm, the spiritual realm, the local realm, is connected in some ways to the larger, I don't even call them larger, to the other spheres. Then I listened to the second of the Steiner episodes where you talk about the social threefolding. And it seems that this idea of Rudolf Steiner, where he's trying to kind of rethink the relationship of economy, of the economy and politics and culture, is, it's not that there are these three separate spheres. It's this, that you can affect everything from anything as long as you're kind of doing it in the true kind spirit. Is that, I mean, that seemed to be where I took it, because I'm trying to tie it, of course, make it support what I'm trying to do. But I mean, how do you think that sort of our knowing if we're doing the right thing for everybody else is informed by this threefolding idea?
Well, I mean, first to say, Rudolf Steiner identified himself as an anarchist. You know, in a way. So,
I mean, he used the word.
Yes. I mean, he had a friend who he was very close friends with, an anarchist. But also he was just in that milieu of all these different people in that area of Europe at the time, artists and, you know, poets, people who are politically minded, philosophers, scientists, all that kind of stuff. There's so much going on right there. And he was at a party where people were just sort of talking their talking points. Like, there was the socialist saying one thing and the, you know, the philosopher saying another thing. And he just looked and he listened to all of them. And I think maybe you and a lot of your listeners can relate to this. He was like, you know, everything each one of these people is saying could be just rebutted by, you know, like rebutted by someone else saying something else. Each one of these points makes sense in its own way, but it could also be completely just taken apart, which is interesting. It's something that Derrida would say, you know, many years later. But he was like, so what is this? And he said, there is no truth, but a coincidence of all truths, right? So the idea, and why I'm bringing this up, is it's not, yes, we do act in the places and moments we have a stake in. And so he advocated this big threefolding project, which is changing the social organism. And this is what I talk about in the episodes that you're referring to. There's a series called A New Spiritual Society, a series of episodes where I just talk and I bring in all these other thinkers, right, from Susan Sontag to Krishnamurti to, you know, whoever, to Franco Bifo-Berardi.
How'd you get them on the show?
Bifo I did have on the show, but the others, yes, were long dead before I started the podcast. But the idea being that the big project is creating a kind of form of social art. So again, this term art is really important, where we begin to engage in the artistic work of creating a new anatomy for society. But we don't just do that by working on the one big broad project. We do it in our own communities, as you had noted yourself, that actually we have these moments of, you know, abolitionism, where someone does a shitty thing in your community, and rather than calling the cops or punishing them, you get together and you say, okay, how do I deal with this? Now, he had a specific way of looking at that, which is you bring together cultural concerns, economic concerns, and political concerns, and you have them all be healthy when they meet each other to talk about this thing that you all have a stake in your community. So you can do it in a small way, and you can do it in a huge way. And so it agrees in some sense with both the things you're saying. And it, in that way, again, just to make it more organic, it's like, you know, the cells are dividing or meeting each other. There's this, you know, symbiosis that's happening and a symbiogenesis that's happening, creating new forms that can make new organisms, whatever. And so that's why he says the social organism, it keeps it in this living level. And I really like that as well. We might just be a few cells or we might be an organ, but we can all work towards the creating this helper being of the social organism that keeps us kind of upright in our interactions with each other. It's not about making a utopia, although I use the word utopia a lot in that series. It's about helping us create a helper for us.
right. To a helper, and that it keeps kind of society and the organism so much more amoebic, you know, that the simple way, kind of the pre-civilized way, or the pre-civilization 2.0 way of doing it, is let's build walls and lock this thing down, you know, create rules and make it these sort of institutional structures, you know, like putting braces on teeth forever. And it's like, no, there's another, you know, getting a helper to help us sort of work on compassion and discipline and processes and things, you know, to have a living, dynamic, organismic politic and society, right, you know, and, you know, and economy. It's like, oh, you mean, right. But, and the thing that's so upsetting to people is, I mean, we're never done. We got to keep doing it and negotiating in an ongoing way. And it's like, yeah, you get to be alive. You know, it's like,
I mean, that's the thing. It's we're doing it anyway, right? Like right. We are doing it. So, I mean, that's the thing that should haunt all anarchists is the concept of, I think it's called rational anarchism, that actually the system we have now is anarchism. And we've just all agreed to do this. And then right. We all just want this thing, right?
Right.
Which is the thing that Wilhelm Reich has to say as well. But it's about, like, how do you want to participate? What do you want your day to look like? What do you want your neighbors to look like in your experience? It's like, it requires maybe a bit more of a different shift in, you know, an altered state of consciousness from the one that you're used to when you feel like you're not doing anything. But you are always participating anyway. And I don't just mean politically. I just want to like make that clear. We're also participating culturally. We're also participating economically. And we might as well, you know, take some direction there. And I think it doesn't have to be, like I said, massive. That's not for everybody. And it's not going to be for everybody. It's not for everybody now. And it's not going to be for everybody in the future. But it is like something about, you know, there's some kind of intention there. There's an intention in thinking, a purposefulness in action, and a purity in feeling that come together and help us achieve this in a way. Now, if I'm to sort of say the best shot we have of getting there, it's through spiritual development. It's through each of us doing esoteric development in our own lives in whatever tradition we feel actually opens us up. And again, not self-development. Self-development's great. It's really important. It's the refining of the character. But spiritual development is the confrontation with the loss of conditions, as we were talking about before. It's like, you probably noticed this in your own spiritual life. It's like, you get to that level, like you spiritually develop, and then you get to a level and you're like, oh my God, nothing's prepared me for what's on this level. I thought I was like kind of getting there, you know. It's the same thing with society, like you just said. So see, actually how we want to change society mirrors our own spiritual development, where we think we've got everything set. We figured it out. We've got gay rights, feminism. We're just starting to talk about post-colonial theory. Maybe we're opening up, you know, some organic food shops and community shared agriculture. Oh, shit. Now, all of those things are being turned against us, seized and turned against us. I wasn't ready for this at all. I can't rely on those tools. I need to actually develop in a completely new society to be able to contend with this. And it's the same in our own lives. You know?
Right. Before we go, I kind of want to end where I should have started. How are you?
Thanks for asking. I'm good. It's such an interesting moment for me because I'm actively creating the next stage of life for myself. And that for me requires a ton of effort, really concentrated effort.
What does next stage mean? Like you're 40 or something?
Well, first of all, I'm 48, but yes, I'm already 48. But I think, you know, next stage for me is being closer to my destiny, which is, there's lots of components to that, but there's lots of, I'm more with the things that I do that are actually the medicine for the world that I also love doing, right? And so it's kind of setting that up, but there's all the practical scaffolding and shit like that around it, right? So it takes me letting go of old patterns, creating new ones. It takes me getting some shit in order that I just, you know, loose ends that need to be. And then it also takes me, like, you know, getting in a certain state of mind. This is where like new age stuff is like super helpful because it's so effective. It's so much more effective than almost all other forms of magic.
Right.
I know that there's like a bitter pill for people to swallow that like, but it's true. And it really helps with planning shit. Now, my real spiritual life is about it, and you kind of talked about this before, like a little bit. In your own life, when you're talking about sort of letting go of all the activity, my real spiritual life is submitting to what's needed of me from the spiritual realm. But when I want to shift things in life, I have to do a lot of activity. Even if it does nothing, it's creating this kind of evincing a sort of aura that then, you know, on the other side of that, I've exhausted myself and I find myself in a new field of being. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and I'm okay with that. I've learned, you know, it's like when I'm now, I hate to say it out loud because a lot of reasons, but I'm preparing to start another book. Right. And I feel like, you know, I think a lot of dogs do this. We had a dog, and before it would lay down, it would like walk in this circle on the rug for a while, like preparing, or it's like, is it doing banishing rituals or something before it, but it walks around this circle a bunch of times and then sits down. And I feel like that's okay. That's okay. So even if the things you're doing to prepare for the next stage are, you know, structural and whatever, they are clearing, configuring, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when you clean the house, you know, because you're agitated.
I know. And they call that procrastination. It's not procrastination. That's my germination, my preparation. It's part of it. Fuck 100%. You. You know, these people who say, oh, what do you do? I love my answer. They always, when I do writing interviews or someone as an author, what do you do about writer's block? And I always said, there's no such thing as writer's block. There's days I don't write, you know? It's like...
Right. And that's part of writing.
Right, exactly.
Like, that is part of writing, right? So, I mean, I was just going to say, I think maybe a good percentage of this stuff that I'm doing is what you do as you're enduring the passage, you know? It's like, I have to keep activity going because this passage is happening. It's, you know, so you... Mm. And then you're on the other side of it. It's not like I think all of it is doing the exact thing, but I know that I do know that I'm on my way to this next step, which I know I'm being a little vague about, but it's just because until it's formed, it's better to sort of, you know. Yeah. But I think I love the writer's block thing because it's like, well, what do you, I don't understand that question either. It's like, well, if you're writing a book, there's long stretches of just sitting there contemplating. Isn't that sometimes a book incubates in you for 20 years or something like that before the idea finds its right spot?
Right. But you imagine if you were like in Disney Animation Building in the 1960s, you have an office and you're supposed to write the next episode of Mickey Mouse. And it's like, I can't think of what he's going to do. You know, that's writer's block. It would be capitalism demanding something. That you can't
right.
Do
we
at
have
the
podcast
moment.
Block, yeah. Podcast block, but no writer's block. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like sometimes I'm like, I've gone through those periods where I'm like, fuck, like who am I gonna have on? What am I gonna do? And I don't really want to talk to anybody right now. So is it fake or am I, you know, how can I do something that's real? Should I just post an old episode again? It's like I go through all that shit and I've gone through periods where I'm just like, man, I don't like any of the stuff I'm doing. I do my best in meeting the person, but I'm much more likely to have it because of the artificial constraint created by, you know, it's not artificial, by the necessary constraint created by that ecotone where real offering meets money and the two have to meet each other. That's actually really important.
Right. If people are going to subscribe and support my podcast, that I'm trying to get more than one episode a week out to them and at least two monologues from me every month. And that's the hardest part, is right, because my monologues, you know, when I transcribe them, they're like between 3,000 and 4,000 words each of, you know, developing an idea. So that's, but if it ever feels like pulling blood from a stone, you know, I stop and, you know, stop and wait and have another conversation.
And it is difficult. Like the further you get in your career or sort of, I would say maybe not the further, but the deeper you get into it, the less capable you are of putting out something that means nothing.
I know, you get more of what you call the word your discernment. You develop more and more discernment and it's like, oh, I've become, you know, most discerning of my own output.
Right. So like what I see a lot of people doing to sort of deal with that is they'll do something that's kind of fun, right? Like I've been thinking about this with my Patreon. I'm like, I think I just need to every month have a conversation with a friend about a book we both read and put that on there and tell everybody to read the book, because that'll be fun. That'll be me loosening things up instead of the demand of real right. offering all the time to actually show how I participate in the joy and pleasure of life would be really nice every once in a while. And I think people will be into that, right? And so I see a lot of people doing that once they get a certain, but it's like when you try to make serious, meaningful, to use the word, meaningful, in-depth content all the time, like one of the worst things you can do is give people something and say it's that when you know it is not that. Right. Like that's really bad for the world. And right. I've done it, you know, I've done it because I feel at times I have no choice, but I really don't want to do that anymore. I really want to step away from that. And just to say one more thing about this, like I know people that write a fucking novel every year or two novels a year. And I mean, God bless them. It's like, it's their skill.
Yeah.
You know, they have a talent or whatever, and they just are cranking them out. But I'm like, man, like, I don't know if this constant generation is actually really good for the field that you're entering this into.
No, if they had more time and more money, they'd be writing less, you know, and they would be doing us a favor.
Totally.
I have writer friends who it's like, you're doing 3 books a year and 600 blog posts. It's like, will you do me a favor and condense all the important stuff into just one book so I can only read one of your books a year? How about that? You know?
Right. Yeah. Or just like, I mean, the more time and money thing is also like, for those who are not in some sort of abject poverty or continuously, like seriously, scarily broke, just learn how to endure a little bit more anxiety about your career and that, like, just chill the fuck out and see what comes in when you're not like anxiously treading water. If you can't do that and your skill is to write another book, fucking do it. Like, yeah. That's great. But if you can, like see what you can take, you know, because that's also a real important skill for the world right now. Don't you think? It's like people talk about AI, the internet, social media, Trump, as if these things have been around for 100 years.
Right.
Like, this is all new. Like, I mean, it's all old shit, but it's like has a new face and like new social negotiations. And it's like, how about you just chill? Like, just try to endure some time before you decide how to respond. Do it right now. Like, just get that endurance going. I think that that's, I mean, but I think when you get a little older, you understand that in a way that you just don't get when you're younger. You know, I probably would have told myself to fuck off, you know, my 30-year-old self or however old I was when I met you would have told me to fuck off in saying this right now, you know.
Well, especially we're living in a world where the volume of stuff that you put out right. when you're young can really help get a foothold in the marketplace yeah. of, you know, and that's reality. Not the one we're lucky enough not to be obsessed with it. But you see, it's still there. It kind of never goes away. You got to pay the rent. You know, it's real. It's real.
And, you know, we recorded a podcast, as you alluded to earlier, that didn't go quite right. I didn't feel like it went right. I think you felt there was something off. I think we have framed it kind of wrong. And then we had all these tech problems around it.
Right.
So it's like, we were just like, no, let's not put that one out into the world. It doesn't make sense. What actually really matters is having this kind of conversation, right. which feels already 100 times better than that other one.
Well, it's much more like, and not totally, but it's so much closer to what happens when we are on the phone talking for 2 hours.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's true. Yeah. And I think it's like,
except not asking you as many questions about sex.
One day,
yeah.
We'll do that episode.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh my god! But thanks for those conversations too. They've served me well over the years. yeah.
I mean, just to say something at the end that I did say on that episode was like something to the effect of like, I just really appreciate. I really appreciate you. I mean, I want people listening to hear this too, like, I'm not doing the podcast thing where you're like, man, you're just like, you're so great. You make me think and like do that. You know, I've been doing this now, the podcast for like 10 years. I've been doing some form of like weird public output stuff since I was a kid. I had a record label. I set up shows, like did all this like kind of stuff. But a lot of people in the past, especially a few years, who do what we do in one sense or another, and you've been doing it much longer than me, obviously a much greater output, but they've kind of fallen down, fallen away, gotten snared in all kinds of shit. And it's just nice to have the conversation with someone I've been having this conversation with for a long time who hasn't who hasn't gotten stuck in the, you know, the bog of sorrows or whatever it is, the swamp of sadness and the never ending story, and just like really just gotten lost and gone wild and crazy. You know, I mean, really thankful for that. I mean, thankful for all sorts of things with you, but thank God that that's the case and that I've got you to talk to, you know?
Aww.
And that doesn't mean don't ever fuck up.
No.
Because you can as much as you want.
It's but perilous.
Like, I'm just
thankful. I know I fucked up, just not in those in those sort of ways, luckily. Yeah.
Yeah.
But boy, it's a fucking journey, I'll tell you that. You know?
Yep.
You know, but I've been learning to experience pleasure and appreciation during it. I mean, there's still such heartache, such terror, such sadness, you know, but feeling more isn't always just feeling more bad. Feeling more is
right.
also
right.
feeling more more joy, connection, and all that stuff. And I wouldn't trade that for anything, you know. All right. I love ya, in case you can't tell. And what, you know, just for the fucking sake of it, why is it against everyone? You're not against anyone. I mean, or do you mean like lean rubbing up against everybody? What do you?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I talked about it on the very first episode of the show. It was like, because that was a time like.
And just for people who don't know, that's the title of Connor's podcast, is Against Everyone.
Yeah, Against Everyone with Connor Abebe, right? So it's, yeah, it was that dual meaning. It was like, I'm going to come up with these like snarky takes, because that was the time of like think pieces. There were tons of think pieces back then.
Yeah, it was the era of Medium.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to have that take. And I was publishing a lot of nonfiction essays and stuff like that around the, and like online magazines where you actually get like a good chunk of money for doing that. And so I was like, I'm against everyone, but also, you know, having come out of that career of sex work around that same time, it was like, but I also want to be pressed up against everyone. I want to hold everyone. I want to be connected, you know?
Hmm.
And so it was just a double meaning. Now, I don't know if it registers the same. And I'm like, do I change the name? But, you know. It's like, that's another IP concern, you know, like where
right.
you can't, you've got to sort of, but yeah, I mean, still feels all right. But I think it's like kind of a put off now to people because it still sounds snarky. Do you know what I mean? If they don't know me and they haven't listened to the show, when I ask a stranger on, you know, have a conversation, they're like, oh, is this going to be a debate? And I never debate people on the show, ever. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. Let's see how it undulates over time as titles do. And we all do. Well, thanks,
undulates.
Connor. You better come back here to the US at some point, where you're welcome and loved by everyone and our administration, especially. if not, I'll take a boat out to Ireland, wherever the heck you are. I'll find you.
I'll come hang out. And I love you too. And yeah, thank you.
All right. Anytime, anything you ever need, you call on me. And that basically is the same for everyone in the Team Human community, especially those who have the wherewithal to become supporting members of the team. It actually costs a lot of time, energy, and money to make this thing. And I'm not saying we're going away, but you can keep this going by becoming a supporting member of the team. And if you can't support by going to patreon.com/teamhuman, you can support just by listening, by sharing, by clicking on little hearts and checks and all those things that are there that help alert other people to know that there's some human who cares about what we're doing here. So please do that. Check out other episodes. And I hope I see you at one of the premieres, one of the live events, one of the many things that we do here at Team Human. Thank you, Connor Habib. You can find out most about him most easily by going wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Read the book, the last book, which is still new, Hawk Mountain, which will surprise you. At least twice. I was surprised majorly twice in there. I'm sure you know the two times I was surprised. Spoiler alert, you will be surprised, but there's too many spoilers to be spoiled. And come back here anytime. We love you. Thank you for being on Team Human. We are produced by Joshua Chaplin, edited and engineered by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.